Today on the Wet Fly Swing podcast, we've got Al Burr, who is going to change your two-handed game when it comes to the spey cast. We discover Al's three biggest two-handed casting tips that will change your spey casting forever. Plus, we get an insight of how Al uses a special pattern to pop his flies and entice more steelhead to come to the fly. Al wrote the book on two-handed casting and has been leading in the spey game for longer than most people alive right now. We get into some great stuff. We talk about Jim Green, the history way back into the 70s, and we take it all the way up to present day where Al is still presenting at events. After today's episode, you are going to find out why constant tension, the power up, and the curve up are all going to make your cast easier and more effective over time. Here we go. Al Burr. How you doing, Al?
Wonderful.
Great. I appreciate you putting time aside today to talk about a very hot topic. It's always a spay in our world is always interesting. It's a challenge for some people. So we're going to talk about spay casting, how you got into it as a kind of a master instructor in spay and fly casting and single, two-handed, all that. But before we get there, take us back to fly fishing. How did you first get into it? What's your first memory?
I'd have to be like 15, something like that. And I thought I could catch more fish. Turned out I could. What it really turned out is I could break more rods.
Right.
But, you know, it became captivating and, you know, I'm pretty much self-taught. So I've pretty much done everything three times wrong. But I learned a lot along the way.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to do it. I'm assuming that you early on didn't have a lot of instruction on casting. Did you kind of teach yourself?
Yeah, but I was real observant. And still I am today. It's like I'm not steadfast and exactly, you know, there's a right way and a wrong way. But I am a believer of something that can get me three more inches. I would do it.
Yeah, right. And so fly fishing came in that age, 15, kind of you're in high school. Where were you at that age? Where did you grow up?
My lineage is from Mount Angel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mount Angel, just right outside of the Willamette Valley.
And we had there's a creek, you know, a small river, you know, within a mile of the home place. And I would just ride my bike down there. And I don't think I didn't buy a fishing license until I actually went to college. And,
yep,
you know, then I found out that you know, might actually want a license because you might get checked. And
yeah, so you were kind of out there going for it in the valley. And what was your, I mean, I have a couple of your smaller books, but you also have a big book on two-handed casting. So you really got into this hardcore. When did that transition happen when you went from just this kid with, you know, barely having a fishing license to now, you know, an amazing casting instructor?
Well, it was like a small cascade of affairs. And, you know, I would never have done two-hand, but I met Jim Green. And he sent me some single hand rods, and it was a dang good rod. And then he sent me a two handed rod. Of course, they're all blanks, and sent me the two handed rod at blank, and told me to meet him on the Skagit on a Pacific day. And it's like, you know, 3 months away. And I have no clue what this thing's about. Didn't know where to put the cork. Didn't know where to put the guides. And it took me like a week to get enough courage to call him and say, hey, you know, I don't know anything about this thing. And where do you put the guides? And of course, you know, knowing Jim, which I didn't know at that time, he just goes, oh, just put a bend in the rod and that'll tell you where to put the guides. Well, I can understand it today, but you know, 1980, that was like the wrong thing to say. But
so he gave you a blank?
Yeah, it was a 16-foot boron. You know, at that era, boron was the cat's meow. And, And it still probably would be if it wasn't such a bear cat to work with. But, you know, great material. But anyway, got the rod together, practiced, tried to figure it out. And luckily, I got that before, I guess it's to some degree, it depends on who you are. In my opinion, I was lucky to get that rod before the modern spey casting came to the States. And so when I was up on the Skagit in those early years, I would schmooze with some of those Canadians that knew this stuff and gleaned off of them. So I learned the figure of eight method, which, you know, is more of a constant tension. And for a fishing type cast, it's far superior. That would be my opinion.
Yeah, gotcha. And Jim Green, remind us again, we've heard the name many times. Who is Jim Green? And I don't think he's with us anymore, right?
Yeah, he passed away in, I think it was 94.
Yeah.
A real innovator, thinker. And, you know, I think he came up with four out of the five ferrules.
Oh, wow.
That go on a graphite rod. So,
oh, right.
You put your rod together, and the only way you can get your rod together is Jim Green.
What was his back in the day in the 80s? What was he doing? What company was he with?
Fenwick.
Oh, Fenwick. So, right, yeah. So he was with Fenwick early on, and then...
Yeah, you know.
What else? And then he transitioned into where from Fenwick?
Well, he retired.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then shortly, you know, in the 70s, Fenwick was the zenith. It was the center of the world.
Yeah.
And by the 80s, they were trying to do a more mass production market, and, you know, that kind of eroded their, you know, gold shining star. And so they became more ordinary. So they, you know, became more generic.
Mm.
Jim retired, and then he worked with Don Green of Sage.
Oh, right. With Sage, yeah.
And that's how I was kind of like Jim's luggage. That's how I was with Fenwick, and then moved to Sage. Mm. And then Sage opened the door to 3M. And this whole thing is just a trail of being in the right spot at the right time.
Yeah.
And there was a vacuum. And to get more effective catching fish when I was going to college, and I was on a, you know, I was paying for the college myself. So it was eat or go fishing. And I thought fishing might be better than eating. I had to make my own lines to get those fish, and because we were running sink tips and streamers and heavy water, catch big rainbows. And that got my line building. And when I met Jim the first time, I told him my problem. My problem was I was trying to chuck a line that just wouldn't fly.
Mm, yep.
And but it was so effective. And when he saw the line, he just looked at me and goes, "Well, who do you know in Seattle?"
Mm.
And it was the same line they were using, or real close, was the same concept they were using in their two-handed rods up there. And he was intrigued in that I had stumbled across this stuff on my own, and I was running it on single hand.
Yep.
That's how we kind of fit together. And then I was building lines all along. You know, in the early 80s, you know, basically you could buy a DT line in the States, and that's about it.
Oh, right. That was it. Yeah, in the 80s, it was just a double taper. There was no heavy. We just had Jim Teeny on recently, who talked about some of the weight, the stuff he was creating back in, I think, around that time, right? More.
Yeah. Yeah, super good guy.
Yeah.
You know, that to some degree, you know, it's like, you know, you could get DT-13s in that era, and that was like the best line ever, because you could cut the two ends off, get two floaty shooty heads, and then you got the center. Well, you can get a couple Skagits out of that. And it was like, man, you can buy one line and get, you know, four or five fly lines out of it. You know, it was fantastic.
Yeah, that is great. Wow. So basically going back, recapping that, I mean, Jim Green was, and I'm looking at a thing on, this is a video out there from 1975. It was a Fenwick thing he did with basically a 16 millimeter instructional film in 1975. We'll put a link in the show notes to this, but he had a lot of the fly casting, right? He wrote a book on fly casting from the beginning. He's got a bunch of things, but how did he originally connect with you? Why did he send you that rod? What was going on at that time? What were you doing?
Well, I was the local club had an annual fly fishing fair, and it was my job to round up the folks. And Jim, I contacted Jim to come down and do casting for us. And Jim came down from Bainbridge, comes down, does the casting, doesn't want any money, and then goes back home, all in the same day.
At the same day.
Yeah, it's like a 3.5 hour drive.
Oh, that's great.
And I'd never forgotten that. And So, and that's why, you know, if I was giving instruction, especially for certification, you know, can't charge. Because that would just be in the back of my mind what Jim would do. So,
yeah, gotcha. Wow. So there it is. So basically you connected. And was the local event, was that the one of the expos? What event was that?
It was long before that.
Oh, okay.
This was with the Santa Ana Flycasters, and we used to do this spring thing, you know, fly fishing fair.
Oh, okay. So this was before the Northwest, the Albany show.
Well, yeah.
Way before.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Wow. And what you're going to be at this year, I think you're going to be at the Albany show, right? Help doing some fly casting.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. I think it's a good show to go to. We just talked to one of the chairs who's leading it, and I think it's going to be a great event. I think they've done a lot of different things this year to kind of mix it up, but that's cool to hear you're going to be there. Hopefully we'll see you as well. So we talked about a lot here. You've got your rods, the two-handed rods. So talk about the book. When did that book, it seems like, I know you sent me a couple of smaller books, but when did the larger book come to be? When did you think like, hey, I need to write a book on this?
Well, it was another Jim Green thing. He got me stuck on this, casting board of governor for the Federation. And, they had a single hand program, and it started out as just a casting instructor. Then it got branched out to be two single hand. So then they come along and they want to do a third one, and it would be two hand. So I got on that committee, and we spent a year doing that, getting a test. And then at about the end of that, I inherited that thing as a chair. And so to get that program to fly, I had to convince the fellow governors that they should get certified. And one of the things that I had learned from teaching already was that not everything you tell them is what they understand. So you can tell them one thing, and then tomorrow they think they said something else. So I made up a book, basically, and had the printers print it. And the following year, that's what I used. And I had 12 governors come to that. I mean, holy mackerel, I had Joan Wolfe
as
a student.
No kidding. Yeah, for your two-handed. So you're teaching two-handed to Joan Wolfe.
Oh, yeah. Talk about scared straight, man.
Right.
It was like beyond an honor plus scared stiff.
Yeah, I could hear you. Wow. And this was at a local event. Was this at an event where Joan's there and you're just basically doing a demo for people?
It was at a conclave.
Oh, conclave,
and
yeah.
I did that for probably 8 years. We do usually those conclaves start on a Tuesday, and we'd go there and have this on Monday, the day before. And a lot of governors would be flying in the day before, so we could just have a class on two-handed. And it was a success. But that's where this booklet started. You know, I had Schollmeyer shoot the photos, and I printed it up, and we used it for 2 years, and Schollmeyer took it to Frank Amato. And Frank wanted to print it. And so I was like,
yeah,
if you're going to print something, you know, we got to do something more than this.
Yeah.
And so that's why, let's say if you opened up that book, probably the first half is the basic cast, and then it shifts. And so basically the first half is the previous book, and the back half is the, has more cast in it. And so, and you know, it's more of a technical manual, which was probably good if you had that and Simon Gosworth's book. You put those two together, you know, you could figure it out.
Figure it out. No, this is great. And I'm looking on Amazon. I'm assuming that maybe that's the best place to find the book, although there's a hardcover and a paperback option, and the hardcover option right now is going for $1,500, almost $1,600. So, and the paperback you could get for $175 used. So is that the best place for people to go track down this book, or how do they find it?
Sorry to say, and I apologize to everybody, but that's it.
It's out of print.
Yeah.
But you have these other books, right?
I have a version that I edited, wouldn't change the format, and publisher was, they more than eager to republish it the way it is, and I'm not. So we're at a point, well, we're deciding who's in charge, and currently there's a limited access.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. So, but it is, I mean, there's, well,
I think,
yeah.
I think at some point I will, you know, it's like a year's work, but it would be nice to have a book on constant tension, which that is something that I think a lot of people misunderstand. And
Waters West Fly Fishing Outfitters is your go-to resource for swung fly techniques, two-handed casting, and anadromous fish. Find out why Waters West has built a cult-like following around their fly tying materials and why they are the go-to resource for the OP and beyond. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/waterswest right now to check in with Ed and Kyle and get all geared up to get on the water. Maybe we can describe that a little bit. What, I mean, because spay casting, there's a lot of challenges people have to pick it. I mean, things have changed a lot now because with the Skagit style lines, you know, people can pick up spay easier versus, say, a 16-foot long belly. But maybe you can describe that, like, if you think about constant tension. What does that mean for somebody listening now who's maybe struggling with the spay cast? And does this apply to Skagit, Scandi, long belly, kind of everything?
Yeah, it wouldn't matter the shape or length of the line. Where they differ is whether you stall or stop in the back loop or back cast or D loop, whatever you want to call it. And if you have any pause back there, which is, it's like a common cold. It's like a small virus left over from single hand overhead. And, you know, you don't have to make that pause in the back. Once you can cross that point and realize that you can just turn and drive forward, then you can regulate the depth of the D-loop, and then you can use spay casting for what it's supposed to be used for, which is limited or no back cast. And the stop-and-go guys, which, you know, basically is forced turnover, they got to have room behind them. Well, then why are you using a spay rod?
Oh, right.
You know, if you need room behind you, what are you doing?
Right.
And to kind of tie this together, I've spent a lot of time fishing junk water because nobody else can fish there. And the fish will migrate to those junky spots because nice big open riffles, they got 10 guys fishing it. And those fish will gradually move away from that. And they will go somewhere where there is nobody waiting. And so these junk spots, which can be a bear cat to fish, or interesting, challenging.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a debate, you know. And it's kind of, I guess, compared to golf.
Yeah.
If golf was a real game, they would play the whole thing with a 5-iron.
Right.
But they got all these different clubs. And they're overpaid then because they just change the club. It's not like a level of difficulty where, you know, in this game, you get one tool and you got to play the whole game with it.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's where, let's say, constant tension allows you to regulate the amount of energy created in the G-loop and then the depth of the G-loop. And, you know, for the folks that, and it's not to pick on the stop-and-go people because it's real easy to understand those principles, but in a roll cast, you need just to bring, drag the line back and get it behind the rod, and then it will, you can roll the entire line off the surface. Well, that isn't very much of a D-loop. And that very limited loop will pick up and drive the entire length of your line. And it could be 70 feet long, and it would still do it.
Mm.
Well, the constant tension will probably drive it even further, and you could have the same depth loop. And this is where you can be jammed up, let's say this time of year, you're fishing in a coastal river, so it's got a canopy jammed with brush. And one thing that those canopies with brush have is on end, every limb has a hand that grabs.
Right.
And so if the fly line even gets, you know, within a foot of that tree, it reaches over and grabs your fly line. And where constant tension will allow you is that you can just bring the D-loop up on your shoulder and then drive it forward. You're not even going to put it behind you. Hmm. Just keep it within your eyesight, turn, drive to the target. And what in coaching folks, especially the stop and go force turnover, they really struggle with that. You know, that's where it's almost like a religion. Once you can get someone to cross over and believe that they can just, you know, draw the rod back and then turn and drive to the target. You know, once they, you know, the limit or the space behind you really becomes null and void.
Yep.
But there's other attributes with it as well because you don't have any more skipping anchors. You know,
Right. That's a big problem, pulling your anchor.
Yeah. And then power generation. So for every ounce of energy to drive the cast to the target, there must be one more ounce stronger energy in the anchor. So if you can do a circle up, you know, and swing up and around, if you're driving upward, so let's say if we draw a circle, a clock face, and if we're going to go and swing around and start at 6 o'clock at the beginning of a D-loop and drive around the 3 o'clock, and 12 o'clock will be the target.
Mm, yep.
So I got this elliptic circle, and so I am just going to pull on the line, get her coming, aim it to the anchor placement, and I might be pacing myself between 6 and 4 o'clock. But once I get to 4 o'clock, I really climb on with the power.
Mm.
And I swing around and just increase the power all the way to 12. And what happens is the energy or momentum created between 6 and 4 is regulated. So that's the depth of your D-loop. But when you turn, as you arc around, when you swing from 4 to 3 to 2, now we have a vertical climb. And if you increase the thrust there, the tension applied, for every action, there's a reaction. So now you applied an upward momentum. So there's an equal amount of momentum pushing down on the tip of your line and your leader, pushing that down. So when you circle up, that tension is pressing your anchor down into the water. So that allows you, once you get to 2 o'clock and you're plowing into it, because I took half your tee loop away because there's a tree in the way. And so you have to generate the same amount of power with half the tee loop. Well, easy deez, because I powered up 3 o'clock, 2 o'clock, pressing harder on the anchor placement. So when I hit 1 o'clock and 12 o'clock, I smack it really hard.
Gotcha.
This is all smooth motion, all tied together, and everything is ramping up to the target. But what happens is that circle up presses the anchor placement, makes it grip, and shoots it off.
Yeah.
You know, it would be about 90, late 80s, 90, somewhere in there. I got to have a couple times sessions with Johan Andersen.
Mm.
And although he was a little secretive on what he would do, but just watching, you know, I'm a pretty good pirate. And that is one of the things that I saw when I quizzed him about it. His defined circle up, it created the line to exit from the anchor placement to rise up vertically. And so it didn't release at a low angle from the water, you know, back towards the caster, then to the target. It actually just rose vertically off the water, perpendicular, and then up went to the target. And that is how he was able to set up a line skewed in front of him. So it's out of placement, out of alignment, and then be able to drive right to the target. You know, you would see it happen and you would scratch your head, but then it was like, oh, he made the line exit the water vertically and in line to the target. It wasn't the fact that the line was placed askew. And that was a nice door open for me. And you know, that compared, let's say, you know, to convince me of constant tension, you know, Jim, this would be a few years earlier, Jim made this. It was a 16-foot 9-weight. And then he made a butt section that had the reverse taper to it, so it was skinny in the handle. And it was a remake of the Grant's vibration rod, you know, from, I don't know, 1920. So this was the rod Alexander Grant used. And so the taper and the butt section went the other way. So the wall thickness was incredible. It was probably, I don't know, 90 thousandths thick. So it's, you know, the butt section is probably worth them. It's probably got $500 of graphite in it.
Wow.
But the wall thickness is super stout, but all the flex is in the butt section. And so when you would swing around and make the cast, you would be in the stop. And out of the corner of the eye, I would see the tip top of the rod. And that rod is torqued in the shape that I swung around in, and then it would drive to the target. And that, seeing that repetitively, and then see a nice cast come out of it, that's what convinced me that this constant tension thing was a reality.
Yeah. And what would be the opposite of constant? So you have constant tension, which is you're not really pausing. Or what would be the opposite of constant tension on a cast?
Well, forced turnover. Just stop and go.
Yeah, so stop and go. So coming up and doing a snap tee.
So you're going to... the problem with if you make a stop, it's mandatory. There's no way out of it. If you make a stop, you have to pause. And then you can start again. So you load the rod, you make a stop, the rod unloads or straightens, and then once the rod straightens, and then you can reapply the power. And the problem with pause is you lose tension of the line, and now you allow slack or waves. The rod will vibrate a little bit, and every little vibration's got a wave, and you got to pull that taunt again. So Depends on how shaky the guy is in the back loop. You know, that just means he's going to have to sacrifice some of his forward cast. And, you know, the constant tension person, it's not the tension's even. It's the tension is always there. And you're trying to, at the first movement of a cast, you're trying to hold on to some tension the entire time, and it's about conservation. I'm going to start my lift, and some of that energy from the lift is in my final delivery.
Right.
So I'm going to try to hold on to it, but there's so many other things that you buy with that, is that since you always keep the line taut, it's ready to go. It's ready to cast. So it's all, this is how they say multiple spiral type casts. You know, why is it possible? Well, as long as you can keep the line taut and tension, it's ready to go. All you have to do is aim the stop. And this is how you can just make these multiple spirals and then, you know, aim the stop. And it'll just shoot off.
Yeah, without a D-loop is what you're saying here, is that you could do, if you keep constant tension and you do the power-up piece that you're talking about, you can do that without the D-loop even coming behind you. Like, so would there be some, there is some D-loop though.
Yeah, the careful thing to be remember is that the D-loop is behind the rod tip.
Oh, and the rod tip, right.
I guess it's easy to teach a student, and it would be practical to put the D-loop behind your shoulder.
Yep.
But in reality, the D-loop is behind the rod tip. And I've tried to get it, you know, to not abide to that so I could get even tighter, and it doesn't work. It's just the same as, can you throw the fly line up on a rock cliff and make the cast? No, that didn't work either.
Yeah, gotcha. This is good.
I mean, I would do anything in some of these spots to, you know, hit the target. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, that's great. And I've been that too. I know I've been in the places where, you know, you just got a tight back, steep cliff behind you, and you just have to punch it out. Then you find a way, you know, you do your best. Sometimes it doesn't do that well. And I know what I was doing wrong now. Like, I didn't have constant tension. You know, I was thinking about it differently. You talked about a couple things here. What would be a third piece maybe you would add to this, to somebody thinking about trying to implement what you teach? You know, you have constant tension, you have the power up, but like you said, and just to clarify and power up, it's instead of have a giant D-loop, what you can do, if you have a big D-loop, you can easily make a giant cast. But with a short D-loop, as long as you power up from, you know, slower to high, 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 and then a big blast at the end, that's what you mean by the power up piece?
Well, because I fish so much junk area, it's like a number of things I discover. I've been doing it for a while, and then somebody points out what the hell I'm doing. And I use this thing called, what we end up nicknaming as a modified D, which is the bottom leg is a V-loop. So you're coming in hot like a bottom leg of a V-loop. And once you get about halfway, you know, to drive the V, you just convert it into a rounding D. And so the bottom leg is a nice flat or low incline, 10-degree incline stroke. And once that rod crosses behind you, you know, behind your shoulder, just curve up and drive to the target just as an increasing thrust, so, or, you know, load or tension, you know, and very effective. I would say, you know, you can get away with half the depth of a V-loop and hit the target. And I'm willing to say you can go further than a V-loop because that, as we mentioned, that vertical rise in the circle up, if you're tensioning the line then, you're also pressing and gripping the anchor. And that anchor grip is equal as important as the forward cast. You know, because you can really hit a forward cast and not have a good secure anchor, and that just doesn't work out. You know, you end up eating a fly.
How do you get the anchor grip, a better anchor grip?
Well, that's in that circle up. We mentioned that, you know, from that rod swinging from 4 to 3 to 2. That's an upward momentum. And because of the rule, for every action, there's a reaction. There's an equal amount of pressure pressing on the line into the water because you have this upward motion. Now, you're going to have the equal amount of motion pushing it backwards or pushing it downward. And this is where that modified, you know, taking a V-loop and cutting it off at start, I would start out, cut it off at 3/4 of the depth of it. And so it's not going to go all the way back and just curve up and drive to the target. And that curve up will really set. And you just got to be, well, you got to give up on that pause in the back. You just can't pause. So you just drive back, curve up, go to the target.
Yeah. When you say don't pause, I'm just thinking you come back with a D-loop and you kind of, I don't know if you almost stop, but you're saying don't do that. You just come, as you swing, you just keep moving. No. There's just never a pause or nothing there.
And you'd be amazed that it's nearly impossible for people to do that.
Right.
The forced turnover people, and I can tell you this from, you know, giving certification tests, you know, which it was never my favorite hobby, but came with the job. But when we'd get these guys that could make really nice V-loops, the next task was to make a D-loop, and, you know, it's almost 100% of them could not do a round D-loop. They would just make these wide Vs because they just instinctively stall at the back end. They just can't increase energy at the back of the loop. And that's why I mentioned it's more like a religion.
Mm.
It's once you can break that and you don't have to pause, you know, it's a whole new world.
Okay. Yeah. And how do you break that?
You know, it's the same as you know, generating a D-loop is very similar to, say, generating the final cast. You know, the folks, they are the same folks that will make a V-loop and pause, the, you know, forced turnover folks. When they come to the forward cast, you know, they tend to flip the tip and pop it, and off it goes. And it's really easy to teach, you know. But you'd have been far better off if you just pulled the rod straight. And the major difference is the guys who use forced turnover, which is a attempt to make a hard stop or block and stop, sometimes they will call, especially in two-hand, you can check your bottom hand and hold the top, and you can really force that hard stop. Well, a hard stop requires timing, and then you got to be at the end of your stroke on your flight plan, where if you just pull the rod straight, the rod will define where that flight plan is.
Right. So it's actually easier.
It's much easier. And one of the things that I had seen, the difference is Jim Green cast in a hard stop, forced turnover. But Joan Wolf uses, so Jim would use press with the thumb, you know, and press with the thumb.
Yep.
So that's forced turnover. Joan Wolf, she uses the base of the hand, and she pulls the two small fingers into the base of the hand, and that is pull rod straight. It's completely different. And yet it can look identical, but it's how you come into the stop. And if you can just pull the rod straight, you can do away with a lot of the after effects after the stop. You know, this rod vibrating or the tip, you know, counterflex, which is the big dip.
Oh, yeah.
All that goes away. But the other thing is, so we get back to this, for every action, there's a reaction. And the negativity of a forced turnover, when you hit that stop and you, man, I really cracked that baby. There's an equal amount of force going the opposite way. So when you pop that thing and check that stop and the rod flips to the, you know, flips over and bangs to the target, there's an equal amount of bang going the, right behind you. And that's on the anchor placement. So this is where you get these anchor releases that are low to the water that snap back towards you, and then they head off to the target. So sometimes, you know, if you get too aggressive or the anchor's not good enough, dang anchor, you know, the fly comes flying back, puts a hole in your waders. And as it takes back off the target, it rips the hole open. And you know, and that's just a matter of, for every action, there's a reaction.
Right.
Where if you pulled it straight, you did away with the forward flip thrust, that pop, you did away with it, and the rod just is rolled straight. One of the things that I use to convey this is, because we get back to the forced turnover people, which, you know, now you're trying to convert religion. But if you take a single hand rod and you're using a double haul and you're stroking that line, what happens if you pull on the line with your line hand late? So I'm going to make the stop with my rod hand, and then I'm going to intentionally extend that haul late after the stop. Well, the line doesn't go any further, but it straightens faster. And, you know, that's something you can do in your backyard, and you can see it happen, and you can pull on that late. And it's a great tool. Let's say if you had a big, heavy, bushy fly, a big bass popper, and you had to drive it over, well, it just hauled late, and she'll pop right next to the shoreline, and you'll get that bass. Well, fly lines unroll, and so do fly rods. So that fly rod doesn't flip over, it unrolls. And that's why we have fast tips and slow tips, because that is the speed in which they unroll. And so by just shifting your mentality to pull rod straight, the total focus is in straightening the rod.
Straightening. And describe that a little bit. What is, when you say pull the rod straight, just kind of clarify that again. What, in a physically, how does that look with the spay rod? Like, what part is that?
It's real technical.
Yeah.
So the phrase is pull rod straight, and the definition is pull the rod straight.
Yeah. Pull the rod straight. So is that in, so what part of the cast, of the spay cast would that be? Where would you be pulling the rod straight?
Up right at your stop, right when you want a loop to project off to the target. What happens is, let's come back to this elliptic thing. Remember, we talked about the back of an elliptic or a circle when we make a D-loop, and the front end of the elliptic is very similar.
Yeah.
Some other things happen. So forced turnover, you know, has a stop, and let's say in a back cast, for every stop, there's always a pause. You can't get around it.
Yeah.
And it's timing sensitive, which is the negative side of it. And the same in the forward cast. We're going to come forward, and we want to time that stop with the front edge of my casting stroke. And that front edge is that bent rod staying on the flight plan, which some would call the straight line path. It's the flight plan that was initiated, and it continues straight to the target, hopefully. And when that rod is driven forward and it's at the front end of that flight plan, you'll make the stop. If you do it too soon, you'll get a funky loop. If you do it even more too soon, you're likely to get a in knot.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah. And So it's very timing sensitive. You know, the guys that are at the, that are casting at the end of their ability, it's not a negativity. It's just, you know, even I have my limitations. So what the hell?
Yeah.
You know, it's, right. You know, so once you reach the end of that, it's your own full turnover. A lot of times what you'll see is the tip of the line stand up, tip of the lighter, and it'll pile.
Yeah.
And that's because right at the beginning of the stop, you rotated the rod and you were pressing with the top hand. That's where that came from.
Right.
And so if you just did away with that and you drove the rod right to the target, stay on the line path. Remember that elliptic shape?
Yep.
And as I get to the end of the motion, I'm just going to curve and pull it back to me. If anyone's rowed a canoe and you're at the front of the canoe and you're rowing that canoe and you got the T-handle in your upper hand and you got the blade in the bottom hand and you're stroking and the guy in the front of the canoe is just powering along. So if you take and pop that T-handle like a forced turnover guy would do, you're likely going to get tired, but you're also going to just splash water. This is where the canoe guy rudders his stroke with the upper hand, and he pulls hard with the bottom hand. And it's the same motion as pull rod straight. As in, you're going to, as let's say the canoe paddle is reaching forward in front of the canoe. Well, that's the stroke loading the rod. And then the canoe paddle digs into the water and you pry with the upper hand and rudder and you pull really hard with the bottom hand. That's the driver. And as that blade goes past you, it's the same as that rod stroke getting at the front of the elliptic on the flight plan. It's just going to come right back to you.
Gotcha.
It's the same in single hand as what Joan did, is that if you pull with the base of the hand, it will do the same thing. Your thumb won't advance to the target. The base of the hand comes back towards you. So, and it basically is taking the bent rod, and as the bent rod is attempting to straighten, you pull on it. It's the identical thing happens if you take a double haul and you pull on it late. All your main goal is to straighten the rod the fastest. I was at, you know, one of the casting things down in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Spearama. It might have been the second one. Anyway, I'm standing next to Timmy Rachev, you know, which is, you know, Timmy's half genius and half insane. And Timmy's standing there, and he just pops off one of his genius things. He goes, "Well, it's clear today the man who straightens the rod the fastest will win."
Yeah.
There is a lot of good meat in that phrase. You can, it's not about how much power, it's about how fast you can straighten a rod. And that's why Whitney Gould can outcast me.
Right.
I can pick Whitney up. She can't pick me up. But she can cast twice as far. And it's because she can keep that line taut and straight, and she can straighten that line faster.
Yep. Straighten the line. That's the key.
The difference is in pull rod straight, your total focus is flight plan to the target, straighten the rod. Where the forced turnover people, they have their same flight plan, but they have this stop. They have to time somewhere at the front edge of the stroke. And one of the dilemmas is when a rod travels through a stroke motion, whether it's front to back, back to front, it doesn't matter. As the further that rod gets away from you, traveling to the end of that stroke, the less control you have of the outcome. So
yeah,
there's times there, you know, that this has been 8 years ago. Server Sednik, which is a, he was a physicist, instructor in Bozeman. And he came with the same concept, but he did it mathematically. And part of it got me thinking about it. And it was another one of these things that I started working on to prove the false. But, you know, I started looking at what he said, and then I realized, holy crap, I've been doing this. And I think, how about for stopping? Because, you know, part of this, I would say a lot of this discussion is converting a stop-and-go type person to accept that there are other possibilities that you could just swing around to drive the target. So that would probably be, once you, that's what I've seen. Once I could convert someone to believe that, then the sky's the limit.
Trout Routes is the most comprehensive mapping app for trout anglers. With over 50,000 trout streams, 350,000 access points, public land maps, and more, Trout Routes is the number one resource for navigating, researching, and exploring trout streams. And it deserves a place in every angler's toolkit. I was in New York fishing recently. My first time in New York fishing, I had the Trout Routes app, and I was able to check out and access public access points through the maze of private property on the rivers we were fishing. And after I got into the stream and was fishing down through a run, I wasn't quite sure. I saw a house down below. I wasn't quite sure where the property lines ended, but given that I had Trout Routes, I was confident where I was fishing, and I was able to assure that I wasn't trespassing. You will be fully prepared with offline maps. You can get driving directions to points of interest, drop pins, add your notes in the app, all while keeping all of your data private to your account only. You can visit troutroutes.com right now to learn more and download the Trout Routes app for free in the App Store today. That's Trout Routes, TROUTRoutes. Start exploring today. Drift Hook is back again, baby. Back for another big year and here to outfit you with the flies you need for your next huge trip this year. From their special nymphs to dry flies to hopper streamers, and of course their Euro Nymph fly kits, they've got you covered. These ship free directly to your door, ready to start catching fish. At drifthook.com, you can find over 50 instructional videos and over 200 articles to improve your fly fishing game. And I've been testing the Drifthook articles with some of our guests on the podcast as we've been verifying that Matt has been spot on with a lot of his content. It's been a lot of fun this year. So search it up this year. You will likely to find Drifthook online teaching you. They also have over 150 verified five-star reviews and a 30-day money-back guarantee. You can head over right now to drifthook.com to support this podcast and a small company doing amazing things. That's Drifthook, DRIFTHOOK.com, and use the code SWING, SWING, at checkout to get 15% off your first order. Okay, back to the show. Yeah, no, it makes sense to me. And I think a lot of people have these struggles setting up the D loop, getting things in line and timing. But it sounds like what you're talking about, if you can get this, it's actually easier to do cast further with less D-loop and do all of this. I mean, is that kind of the case? And I guess that's the first question I'd have. And then also, so would you say it's easier than actually doing the stop and go?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Because stop and go has timing.
Yeah, it's timing. That's the challenge. That's timing for a single hand caster too is always the struggle, right? Because, so, yeah.
Yeah, part of this would be talking about what's the difference between forced turnover, stop and go, versus constant tension,
yeah,
figure of eight. And they're taught differently, but because there's no timing. You do away with timing and you convert it to rhythm. So now it's just the pace of movement. It's another phrase where it would be old Scottish gilly. You know, if this was 1970, it would be okay to say that, but by 1980, you know, that was taboo. And everybody, you know, and it's because the guys who were promoting forced turnover or modern spay casting would demonize they would draw a big figure of eight and hold on to the tension and drive it, smash it into the water, and you know, you get this big piled anchor. And so they were, you know, promoting a shotgun lift, very lineal type casting, you know.
Yeah.
And they were very successful in converting. But in the meantime, what it did was force people to wade out further, and they're standing on top of their fish, and, you know, they're thrashing about. And they didn't catch any more fish, but they also, you know, wrecked the water so someone can fish behind them.
Right.
What I've also seen is guys that fish at night use figure of eight because it's based off of rhythm. And so you can close your eyes and make a cast.
And how does that figure eight kind of, how would you describe that?
Well, actually, when it's taut, it actually is a, if you took an eight and laid it horizontal, you'd end up with a figure of eight. Because if you did a crescent lift and a round lift, oh, that's the rise of one side of the eight.
Oh, gotcha.
And then you drop, descend, and you, that's where the X cross is. And then you curve back up, that's your circle.
Oh,
up.
Yeah, yeah, I see it. Yeah, yeah.
And then you swing back down, across the crossover again.
Yep.
And then, because you can do loops like that. You can just swing back and forth. You'd look like a orchestra.
Yep.
I think that's probably where they got the idea. They probably saw a guy doing a figure of eight in 1840, and they probably thought that would be a good way to my band.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Well, let me come back to this force turnover guy converting. Most guys who use stop and go V loops, no matter what the degree of excellence, you know, superb casters, acing a certification test. But when that same person, if I asked them to do a D loop, they'd draw me a wide V loop. Then I'll ask them to do a snake roll, and they will draw a round D loop in a snake roll. And most casters do that. And why is, come back to another physics, is a body in motion tends to stay in motion. So we can envision why something flying straight wants to stay straight. But a body in rotation has a tendency to stay in rotation. Mm. And this is where someone will start a snake roll, and that's in a circular motion, and they will naturally swing around into a D-loop and make a round D-loop. And for someone who wants to investigate this, that would be one avenue to start, is just stare at, you know, your arms in the fly line and do, you know, snake rolls. And, you know, that has a strong tendency to always draw a D-loop. And then, you know, I would work on cutting the distance, you know?
Yeah. Is that your recommendation? Like, if somebody's listening now and they want to try to implement some of what you're talking about, what would be a few action items they could do, you know, today or this week?
Converting?
Yeah. Or now, and what would be a resource? Like, you have this book, which is out of print, Two-Handed Fly Casting, Spey Casting Techniques. Where else could somebody go to take this further? If they're hearing this, they're getting some of it, but they really want to take it further, what would you tell them?
Well,
is there anybody else teaching? Is there anybody else teaching this other than you?
Yeah, you could. There's a group that teaches here in Salem on Saturdays.
Oh, yeah?
You know, they've been seeded with this constant tension virus. And they do with the rest.
Who's that group? Is that the Lynn Benton group?
No, it's actually Dwight Kruman started this, who is a master, you know, federation.
What's his last name? Dwight?
Kruman.
Oh, Kruman.
And he has two, he's up in his years, so he's got two young guys, James Gritzman and Jonathan.
Yeah.
Fuzzy memory. We got two. There are two. They're certified master single hand, but then they're also certified two hand.
Okay. Well, we'll follow up with you. If we get some questions for people, we'll try to track it out. But basically, are some local people, and are there any other books out there of anybody you know of or any other resources people are teaching this?
No, not really. And I've seen some of those Skagit guys claim that they're doing constant tension, and I chuckle. You know, it's because what I frequently, you know, because I'm from the era before that.
Yeah.
You know, so I probably taught their parents.
Right. But, yeah.
You know, I made my Skagit line in 77. So, and I didn't have a book. And that's before Al Gore invented the internet.
That's right. And what about somebody like Simon Gosworth? Is his teaching similar to, I'm not sure if you're familiar with everything he does, similar to what you're talking about, or is it different?
Some degree similar. Yeah, I would definitely say it's good. He is more over in the forced turnover. That's why I said earlier, you know, if we had his book and my book, the two go together quite well.
Oh, okay.
His is more of a story log, and where mine's very little story, and all it's more of a technical manual.
Okay.
So the two got to go hand in hand.
Gotcha. What about videos? I see a couple of videos out here. One is Summer Steelhead PhD School with Al. I'm not sure where you did this. It looks like the Deschutes, but are there any videos? Is that something that would be interesting to look at? I see on Spay Pages, there's Al Burr's Modified D V Loop. There's some discussion there. I see you out there. You're around. There's the flyfishingguideschool.com. Are these all things that you're affiliated with? Or these are older things?
Well, some of the things I remember. And
yeah, some don't. I mean, some of these are old, probably.
Some of the things I have no clue.
Well, but here it is. Here's a question for you, Al. Let's look at the Spay Pages. Shout out to Spay Pages. But it said, somebody here said, has anyone seen DVDs or online videos illustrating the Modified D / V loop as described by Al Burr in his book, page 29. So, and let's see if we got any answers here. I believe, here you go. Here's one answer. I believe Simon Gosworth talks a little bit about Rio's models, you know, in their video. I mean, there is some discussion out there, but again, it seems like you are the one that needs to get into these discussions to clarify, but sounds like there's not a lot of good, like go to this spot to learn exactly how to do this.
Yeah, it's more, you got to do it. And remember I mentioned about this conversion of breaking that invisible wall of pause, stop and pause. And once you can break that, then you can discover, because to really get modified D, there's no stop or pause in that backstroke. And I mean, you're in a real tight spot. You can get it up to about where your shoulder is. And I can tell you, it's coming back really hot. And when that rod shaft gets about to where your shoulder is, you just lift up like you're curling a 120-pound curl bar, and you swing around and you smack the target. And all I can say is, if you're picking up a two-handed rod and you think you're going to spay cast, it's about zero back cast. You know, if you're needing, it's reasonable to say you need a rod's length of room behind you. That's reasonable. But in reality, if you had constant tension, you can get your back up against brush and make a cast. As in, just to prove that point, in the back of my book, there's a photo of me standing on some pillars, and actually I think I'm about knee deep, but it's pillar basalt, so I'm actually standing on a little 12 inch square, and it's you know, 20 feet deep in front of me, and these fish stack in the back end of that. But the problem is there's no room for a back loop, and so I did a two turn spiral, and this is where this, you know, sink tip, or they call Skagit lines now. But a two-turn spiral and hit the stop. And the photo caught how big the D-loop was. And I didn't get a bite on that swing, but in three more swings, I did get a strike.
Yeah.
And that's on the snake in January.
Oh, on the snake. Yeah. What is your home river like when you, like over the years, you think of your, where you're spay casting, where you spend your time? Is this steelhead, winter steelhead, summer steelhead? What is that?
Well, my home water here would have been the Santa Am, but...
The North Santa Am or either one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a spectacular river, and it, you know, in the heydays, during in the 80s, it was very good fishing. And, you know, now, you know, it doesn't have any fish in it.
Right. It's all changed. What is the, if you were fishing for summer steelhead on North Santa Am or the Snake or wherever, what would your line set up, like rod, length, weight, line be?
I use two rods over there. I spend, you know, a month and a half or so fishing in the fall. And I run basically two rods, and I actually scratch my head on, you know, why I use it. And one's a eight-way, it's a Sage X, 13-foot for an eight, which is a nice stiff spout. I should call it stiff, but well-supported all the way through. You can hit that rod really hard, and she's going to, you know, straighten out really nice. And it's a great 100-foot distance. You know, it doesn't want to go more than 100 foot. I use that for a wet fly, run on like a 40-foot hit limit. And then I got an igniter. What the heck is that? It says 7126. 12.5 foot for six or seven, and run a floating head on that and run a surface fly. And really comes down to how far. I run a popper, popping for fish is taking skating flies to the next level where you can really promote or provoke a strike out of a fish. And there's been moments that I could tell you that, you know, I forced the fish to strike.
Yeah. And this is on a, like a wet fly, just swinging flies for summer steelhead.
Yeah. And I know it's true because I've had, you know, folks come fish with me and I've coached them on it. And once they stopped stripping that fly like a, you know, a streamer, you know, we're not fishing for Dorado, but if they can make that pop real short, you know, they can force all those fish. And the minimum, what, you know, I forced whitefish to hit it.
Yeah. And what do you mean by, and what fly would you be popping? What would be a typical fly?
Little surface fly. You know, the best fly I've seen is just a little buck bug, you know, like a size six. So it's only maybe an inch long, you know.
Like what would be the fly? A buck bug? Would that mean like a bucktail caddis or something like that?
A buck bug is, everybody's familiar with a bomber, but
a
buck bug is also a Lanning salmon fly, but it doesn't have the front wing and the tail end is real short. And the problem with the front wing, it just pushes the fly out of the fish's mouth. And the same with a long tail. It just pushes the fish up.
Oh, yeah, I see. A buck bug is basically like a bomber, but without the big calf tail sticking out.
It's a woolly worm.
Yep.
Made out of moose.
Hackle going the other way.
Yeah. It's just a moose woolly worm.
Moose.
I mean, it's nice to get one rise out of a swing. But with buck bugs, I've had as many as five.
Of the same fish or different fish?
Same fish, same swing.
Yeah.
You know, so you got that
That's
fish
amazing.
So jacked up.
Yeah, he's just, what do you think that fish is doing? When he's going for that buck bug, what's it feel like on your, when you're swinging and he's hitting that five times, what's it feel like on your fly line? Does it feel like a tap or a tug?
No, it's a surface fly. He's blowing the hole in the water.
Yeah, so it's going crazy.
Yeah, because it's a surface fly. It's just going to blow a hole in the water.
Yeah.
So let's say you cast out. You got a spot where you know that fish, so it's high block, and you cast out and you bang that fly right on the water, pow, and let it sit. Give it a two count, three count, and then start letting it swing. It'll start skating. A lot of times, as soon as it hits the water, if you've got a fish laying behind the rock, the fish will blow up on it.
Wow. But,
okay, you cast into a known zone and hits the water, start skating, give it a pop. And just it's more of a, just a close of the hand, but you just want that buck to barely move, disturb the water, so it's alive. And then you go back to skating, count to four, do it again. And you can force that fish to come for it. And if you get the fish really jacked up, you know, they will miss it, and they will spin around. And a lot of times, you know, if you can see the head coming up, you drop the line to them. You're trying to cut slack so they can just hoof it. And so that gets missed. So some fish, you know, are just rolling on it. You see them, they roll on it and push it under the water. And it drops back a foot or so, starts skating, give it a pop. Boom. And that fish, it'll circle around, hit it again. And I've had as many as five on one swing.
Yeah. Wow.
This year, I think I had a three. I guess some people count how many 20-pound fish they caught. And I've had a few. It's okay, but it's not my cup of tea, you know.
No.
You could go Chinook fishing and catch big, heavy fish too. You know, it's like,
yeah.
What I get a kick out of is, and I've seen large fish just get so jacked up, and I mean, it's like you want to step out of the water. It's
wow.
Like, man, that fish is so jacked up. And they're missing the fly, and they're spinning around, and they're taking another schwack at it, and it's like, whoa, you know.
Yeah. Is this the Clearwater? Are you spending time on the Clearwater?
I did in the 80s, but I thought it got too crowded by 90.
Oh, yeah. So, well, where are you fishing now? Where are you hitting steelhead now?
I spend a lot of time on the Snake.
Yeah, like the actual main stem Snake River.
Yeah.
Yeah, not the salmon or any of that, but the Snake. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I fished in the salmon, but I don't care for the... It has more fish, but, you know, that has a distinct high water line, and, you know, so, you know... I don't know. It's not like that this huge, which that's a very stable river. It's very boring there.
Yeah.
At least the Snake has got a combination of high water disturbance and then regular flow, where the salmon, man, holy mackerel, you know, the first 30 feet is just a war zone.
Yeah, I hear you. What is the your line? So you mentioned the 13-foot 8-weight, the 12.5, 7, 6, 7 weight. What would be the line you're using? What would be one somebody can maybe buy off the shelf, or could they?
That's a toughie.
Yeah. Is there anything
that's
I think?
A personal thing.
Is it more of a? I'm just trying to get the thing everybody talks about now: Skagit or Scandi, right? I mean, is it any? Are your lines anywhere close to either of those two?
Yeah. Most of what people think of Scandis are like a 30-foot long head.
Yeah, exactly.
And the downside of those is they don't fly very far. So you know, one of the physics that you just can't get around is once the loop straightens, it descends. And the problem with a 30-foot head is it straightens too soon, and so it kind of knocks you. You know, it's hard to get a 30-foot head to go past 80.
I struggle with the Scandi. I mean, I can do fine out there without wind, but if the wind comes up, I'm toast with like a typical Scandi type of line. And I'm not a great caster either.
Well, I would agree in that. I would say it is the fly line you chose, because it's very popular. And this is where design and the internet become a negativity. And the triangle taper is very popular in Scandi. And it's because of the buying, it's the heebie-jeebie in the public. And so they buy a continuous one, a mono taper that's 30 feet long. Well, a mono taper is really good for roll casting, but as soon as you go to shoot line, it is like the worst performing line. And then we go, I'm going to add the wind like you mentioned.
Yeah.
So now you've got this wispy end that, because the mono taper is pacing that unroll, immediately as you make that loop, the heavy part of the line goes around to the bottom or the rod leg of the loop, and it's pulling that loop open. And then you have the wispy end that doesn't have much mass, and you try to drive that in the wind. It was not the line length that was the negativity, it was the line shape. And I just chuckle over. So when you asked about the lines, most of the lines I prefer are homemade, and it takes a pretty good wind to knock me off the water.
Yeah, right. You need some good
stuff. And, it, you know, like if driving a surface boat, you need a very positive turnover. And so now we got a zero back cast problem. So you need some mass in the back end that you can create your small D loop or a modified loop and just swing up and drive. So you can have, because a lot of times I like a surface fly, 50 feet is a pretty good, reasonable length. 60 feet is getting a little bit out there. But once you get to 70, it's really hard to get to manipulate the fly.
Right.
This is where I mentioned, maybe I was headed to earlier, is what I've seen is if I got to throw past 70 feet, I'll just pick up the wet fly and just use that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to see the boils with the wet fly. No. And I'm back to searching where, if I can fish shorter on that, I can stay on the shore. Real small D-loop, don't touch the water. Now I can catch the fish that are laying like 4 feet offshore, and I can just creep along. This is one of the things that I saw Harry Lemaire do, and I was scratching my ears, like, yeah, what the hell is he up to? And but he could catch fish. And those, if those fish haven't been walked over, they'll lay right up against the shore.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you have something. You sent me a couple of things. One was How to Design Fly Lines by Al Burr. This is a kind of a paperback, a little book manual. So is that something people can purchase out there to get, take this a little deeper and grab that book?
Yeah, Poppy's got it.
Oh, Poppy's got it. Good. And what's the other one? You sent one on fly casting too. You have a similar. What's the title of that one?
That's Fly Casting Mechanics.
Yeah. Fly Casting Mechanics.
That is probably a combination of, you know, articles and writings, etc. So it's like several different things all mushed together. And its last use was a few years ago. It was a continuing ed class. And it's, I had the focus to battle the forced turnover people, because I knew I was going to a room of forced turnover people. And so it does a pretty good job of bashing, comparing the two, you know, and the positive and negative, and all the negative luggage that can come with forced turnover. There's just, you get a whole bunch of negativity with that if you're not, you know, practicing, etc.
Right.
Where over it, in the constant tension stuff, a lot of that isn't even approached because you're using rhythm. You know, it just doesn't even come into the game. And so the basis of the cast is simpler. And one of the things I would love right now is to have a day with Jim Green, because I would just tear that positive stuff all apart.
Oh, right. Right, right. Yeah, so you've learned a little bit since Jim sent you that first rod back when you were a younger person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Who else? We're going to get out here pretty quick, Al, but who else are the, some of the people out there that you look up to that are, you know, either are not around now or are still around? Like some of the, like Jim's big name. Who else? You talked about Joan. Anybody else we might highlight?
Yeah, I think to kind of formulate my beliefs, I use Jim Green, Joan Wolf, and Jørn Andersen.
And Jørn, yeah, yeah.
And I saw them as three folks that were operating in excellence. And I thought, you know, if I could just take all three of them and smash them together.
Right.
Just keep pouring them together, mixing them back and forth. and use whatever comes out. That would be the best. And I still think that was the right way to go. And probably one of the other things, and it was actually in rod building with Jimmy, you would take everything you believe, throw it on the ground. And so you got all of your rules that you live by. You throw it on the ground, you look at it, and you pick up a rule and you test it. And if it works, you use it. And so it forced you to review all these things that you believed in. And that was really healthy for me because you get all these myths over time, like Lefty Craig, line follows the rod, Well, that's kind of true, but it's not always true. The line follows the tip, but travels to the momentum. Now, you can see how you can set up a cast with constant tension, and you can drive that ankle placement exactly where you want it. You can decide how big the D-loop is going to be with how much space you got, and you can hit the target. And, I think constantly testing your beliefs with reality is a very healthy thing.
Yep, this is perfect. And we mentioned the Northwest Fly Tying and Fly Fishing Expo. So you're going to be there. What are you going to cover at that event? Are you going to go in deep to some of the stuff we talked about here? What can people expect?
Yeah, they've got some sessions there, and those would be, they call it a casting doctor. So you come there and... in my session, you would, whatever you want to learn, you would ask, this is what I want to do. And then you might have to cast, and then we'll see if you can actually do it. Because sometimes you have missing the basic elements, so we can't even get to a specific element. But it's basically taking the student and taking that student in that session to the next level.
Yeah.
And, or, in anything else. So it's basically, I'm their servant for the session. I'll answer what I can and what I know.
Yeah. So you're just going to basically be there to answer questions. And if people want to take this conversation further, they can actually see you demonstrating it.
Yeah. Cast on the water, bring your rod, waders.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So there's going to be on the water and on the water class.
Yeah. You bring your rod.
Which water? Where's this going to be?
Well, that casting pond is, it's just south of the buildings. They'll have a map on the website. It's in Timberland Park, which is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If you went to all the back, the south end of the parking lot and looked out across the road, you would see a pond.
Okay.
We do the casting on the south side of that pond.
But, this is amazing. Yeah,
It'll have, I have to take a guess, but six different instructors or more, six or eight. And you could take a dart and they're all as good. You can't go wrong.
Will they all be, but they won't all be teaching a similar thing that you talked about today, right? It'll be a little different.
Well, you could ask them.
Yeah, see, maybe they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They might have that constant tension virus. And
yeah. This is great. Awesome.
But I think, let's say, as you're wanting to wrap up.
Yeah.
I would ask people to consider this, is if you're going out on a trip, most people think it's kind of reasonable to pack your waders first. But I would tell them, practice your casting first.
Yeah.
Because being able to cast somewhat well is far better than having leaky waders. And just invest in yourself. Do some practice. And probably the best learning thing that I had is fighting through this on your own. In the 80s, with Sage and into the 90s with 3M, I did a lot of fishing and even more casting. And so casting was pretty much a daily thing, and constantly, you know, tinkering on rods. That low action rod, old school technology, hunt for, if you can't find it, make it, a double taper line. Why do they don't make double taper lines anymore? Why? It's because they're not easy to cast.
No.
And who is the best teacher you're going to have? Well, it's that 75-year-old nun with a 5-foot ruler. And she is going to beat the crap out of you if you can't make your letters crisp. And that's what the moderates, like an old sage brownie, just 40 millions graphite, slow action.
Yeah,
it's going to be persnicketive. You can't just force it. Then you put the DT line on it, and the expectation and flight is the same as your high-tech fishing outfit. Make your casting outfit to be a good monitor. That is a helpful friend. Make your fishing outfit something that is easy to cast, high performance, get her done. So you can be half asleep in the morning and hit that 80-foot mark with a breeze. But in practice, you need someone who's going to criticize you, coach you, and that's where that DT line and slow action rod and personal initiative to get it out and fight with it. It will throw a narrow loop when you decide to make the right movement.
Right. This is it. Good. Well, I think Al will leave it there, and we'll send everybody out to the nwexpo.com. That's probably a good place. I see your classes on Friday at 10 a.m., so hopefully people can engage with that. But you also maybe be around the show. People can touch base with you. And yeah, this has been a lot of fun. I think some of your teachings here, you know, are going to require another follow-up, because I think that this has been awesome, and I feel like we're just scratching the surface. So hopefully I'll see you at the show. Maybe I can get a little insight from you there and we can shed more light on it. But I appreciate all your time today, and thanks for diving into this with us.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity.
That is a wrap. You can grab all of the show notes at wetflyswing.com. And please follow us on Instagram and share this episode out with someone you love. Please send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com, if you have any feedback or want us to put together an episode on this podcast for you. Check in anytime. I hope you enjoyed this podcast and would love to meet up with you on the water. We have new fly fishing schools going all year long and all around the country, so if you want to connect, let's do it right now. All right, time to get out of here. I hope you have a great evening. I hope you have a great morning or great afternoon, wherever in the world you are. And I appreciate you for stopping by and checking out the show today. We'll talk to you soon.